My great-grandmother was a night nurse in the 1920s. Every night around 9 p.m., she would wait for the streetcar to transport her from her apartment on one side of downtown to the hospital on the other side of downtown where she worked. She wore a pristine white dress and white high-heeled shoes and stockings and a white nurse's cap pinned into her upturned hair. She studiously avoided eye contact with the men who loitered at the bus stop because men who loiter at bus stops are not men that women should waste their time on. Everyone thought she should take a cab. It was dark by 9 in all but the highest of summer, and it wasn't the finest part of town. It certainly was not a place where a young woman should stand alone waiting for the trolley car. But Dell felt, since her taxes paid for the bus system, she was just as entitled to use it as any man. Why should she pay extra for taxi cabs? When boarding the bus one icy November night, she felt a jolt under her arm and realized that someone was running off with her purse. The bus driver cried out and rose to chase him, but Dell was way ahead of him, taking off down the pavement. She chased him down the slippery street, and the thief was surprised to hear her yelling behind him, and he turned, which gave her enough time to catch up with him and grab her pocketbook back. But he pulled on one side, and she pulled on the other. He said, "Are you crazy?" And she said, "Young man, I am not the one stealing pocketbooks." She gave him a quick kick to the shins. He fell on the ground, and unfortunately, she fell too. Dell broke her arm and the thief was gone into the night, although she did have her pocketbook back. Later at the police office, the officer said, "Why didn't you just let him have the purse?" While looking at her plaster-bandaged arm. "You won't be able to work now for 6 weeks. What was so valuable?" Nothing in the bag was valuable. It was a few hairpins and her return bus fare. But straightening her shoulders, she said to him, "It isn't about the pocketbook. What kind of world would it be if women just let men run off with their possessions? Not the kind I want to live in." The issue, of course, was respectability. While it was unfortunate that young men ran off with purses, social rules dictated that the ladies who owned those purses did not then chase them down to the street and kick them in the shins. They did not wrestle young men to the ground. They did not take the bus alone at night. There were social rules that governed behavior, and there still are. Rules that you sacrifice at your own peril. The police officer thought that a broken arm was Dell's punishment for her wildness. There is a phrase from the Christian tradition that I really love and I think about often when faced with social norms that feel oppressive. It's taken from the book of John in the New Testament. John is the mystical gospel, the woo-woo weird gospel in the Bible. The writer says that Jesus is responding to concerns from his followers about how mistreated they are. So Christians back then were a really egalitarian bunch of people. They had freed and still imprisoned slaves that worshiped with them. Women regularly led worship services, which was approved by Jesus. They had slaves and free people worshiping in the same space with married and unmarried women. They got a lot of flack for sacrificing respectability. Jesus said, early Christians were meant to be in the world, but not of the world. Have you ever heard that phrase before? In the world, but not of the world. He says, if you belong to the world, it would love you as its own. But instead, you're doing this alternative life, and so there are problems. You're going to get flack from the world. This phrase is kind of crazy. In the world, but not of the world. What on earth does that mean? But as Unitarian Universalists, we are a people called to be in the world, committed to transforming this world, the community that surrounds us, instead of holed up in a monastic community or in a cave meditating somewhere, which was a popular choice for those early Christians. Forget all the persecution and just go to a cave and meditate. Unitarian Universalists aren't meant to be in a barred-off community like Amish folks or Hasidic Jews. We're in the world so that we can change the world. But the key to being transformative is that we don't become of the world. Our values can't gradually fade into the values of popular culture. We don't succumb to the temptation to worship money or career success. We live in this world side by side with our neighbors of different or no faith, but we're not of the world. We're Unitarian Universalists, and we're set apart by our seven principles and by our dedication to a just life. In the world, but not of the world. This Olympia Brown understood. Who's heard of Olympia Brown? Anybody? Yeah, I love Olympia Brown. Olympia Brown was raised on a universalist, she was raised a universalist on a farm in rural Michigan, and she believed deeply in the universal love of her creator. Now, at that time in the 1840s, a more evangelical faith was popular. It was in vogue. It was a real fire and brimstone faith that emphasized sin. But Olympia's mother, Lethea, was a radical thinker, an early feminist, and an ardent believer in the universal love of God and the mothering aspects of our Creator. She believed that the holy was kind and that hell was a humanly created fable, and that's what she taught Olympia. Sheltered by rural life, Olympia had no idea how radical universalism was until she attended Mount Holyoke College. There, new students were required to register under one of three titles: professing Christian, hopefully pious, or hopeless. Who would self-identify as hopeless? I mean, even if you weren't Christian, I'm not going to write down that I'm hopeless. Evangelical services and prayer meetings were an everyday occurrence, and eventually faculty and students pressured Olympia into attending. She had never heard of the angry God that was portrayed. She didn't know about the venomous wrath and the everlasting hellfire. This was not a spirituality she had ever seen on her rural farm. She wrote her mother in distress, and Lethea responded, "Darling, it would cause me the most poignant sorrow were you to become the dupe of superstitious bigotry. Dismiss the subject of creeds for the present and be content with a pure heart, a conscientious discharge of duty, and a trust in God. I have confidence in your excellent plain common sense. Use it. Don't regard the notion sometimes advanced that it is wrong to use reason in religious opinions." Olympia was thrust from foreign life to academia, and she was suddenly very much in the world. How could she resist conforming to the views of her peers and professors? She had never attended Sunday school. She had never read the Bible. How would she know what words to use to combat what they said the Bible said? How could she resist conformity? She decided to arm herself for this battle of wits. She wrote to the Universalist headquarters in Boston asking for a reading list, which they sent along. And she found that her evangelical preachers were lifting verses out of context. They were wielding fear and endless torture to manipulate followers into obedience. This made her mad. It made her really mad. It makes me really mad. Olympia felt she was called to be in the world, preaching universalism, but not of the world. She insisted on thinking for herself and applying reason to her faith. This was Olympia Brown's first chance to sacrifice respectability. Yes, it would have been more polite to just quietly agree with her peers. At least publicly, it would have made her more friends and not caused waves. But Olympia realized that respectability was overrated and spent her time at Mount Holyoke and later at Antioch College changing the way that professors thought about women's education. When the president of Mount Holyoke decided that young ladies should not go into town unchaperoned, he hired a babysitter from Boston to attend to them. Offended by the idea that young adult women needed an overseer, Olympia convinced her fellow students to only speak German in the woman's presence. Only speak German to her and around her. And within 2 weeks, the woman had quit and gone back to Boston. The college president got the message, and no further babysitter was hired. At Antioch, she challenged the idea that it was not appropriate for women to speak without a manuscript. So this doesn't make sense to me, but for some reason, in the 1800s, women were allowed to make speeches in the classroom if they had papers. But if you didn't have papers with you, only men could speak without papers. Men had to memorize speeches, and women were not supposed to do that. I don't get what the difference is at all. But anyway, at Antioch, she said, "Well, I can speak without a manuscript." And they said, "No, you have to use one." So she rolled it up in her hand and went up and spoke, but she just left it in her hand. And she said, "What? I have my manuscript. It's right here. I'm not going to look at it." Olympia's experience with hellfire preachers inspired her call to ministry, much to the shock of everyone around her, including her parents. Well, there were a few lady preachers out west, Montana, Wyoming, Idaho, out far afield. They were very controversial, and they were usually completely unpaid. Olympia wanted to go to seminary. She wanted to be recognized by the American Universalist Association, and she wanted to be paid for her work. She applied to all the liberal seminaries in the United States, 36 of them, and was rejected every time. Finally, she received a handwritten note from the president of St. Lawrence Seminary in New York State. He wrote that he didn't believe that women were called to ministry, but that her call was between her and God, and he wouldn't intervene. He added he didn't think her reception at the all-male seminary would be friendly. She didn't think she would have a good time because the men were going to give her such a hard time. But she was welcome to come if she saw fit. The president of St. Lawrence thought he was giving her a very gentle rejection letter, but Olympia saw an opening. So she got on the train and went to New York State, and she knocked on his door, much to his surprise. Olympia Brown was the first woman ordained into ministry by her denomination in the United States, and that was in 1863. And she went on to serve congregations across the Midwest and the Eastern Seaboard. Later in life, she turned her full energies towards suffrage work. And at 85 years old, she was one of the first women to vote on November 2nd of 1920. In her lifetime, she lost countless friends, family members, and nearly all her suitors as she sacrificed respectability for a greater cause, the cause of feminism and universalism and fighting the tyranny of oppressive, sin-based religion. But Olympia knew that respectability was overrated, and so she charged on toward a more equitable world. So, what is our call today as Unitarian Universalists? Where are we called to sacrifice our respectability? How can we live in the world but not be of the world? Let's be inspired by our foremother, Olympia Brown, and sacrifice respectability for the greater cause of a better world.